You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Just by way of introduction, the people had followed God through the 10 plagues, through the Red Sea. This was pretty powerful, exciting. And yet now we're at a point in the narrative in which we are asking the question, can they follow him in the day-by-day mundane trek through the desert? I've talked to some guys who have said, man, I would totally die for Christ. And I've wondered in my heart, then why aren't you living for him? It seems like one of those things where it would be very spectacular to be there at the center of what God is doing. And yet the day by day, you know, present yourself to God as a living sacrifice, not a dead one. Romans 12. Can we pass that test of just sticking with God over the long haul? What we're going to see here tonight is that God uses a series of tests to strengthen the faith of these people. Test number one, the bitter water at Marah. We begin in Exodus 15, verse 22. Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. If you were a Hebrew speaker, you'd be laughing because the word Marah means, any takers? Bitter, yeah, that's hilarious. Anyways, this is the track that they were taking here. Across the Red Sea, somewhere in the Marah Elim, through the desert of sin, not our sin, that's just a term that was used at the time, like Sinai doesn't mean Sinai or something. And then down into Rephidim. That's their travel. Verse 24, the people grumbled against Moses. They're out there in the desert, 3 days, no water, saying, what are we to drink? Now, on the one hand, I get it. They're 3 days into the desert. It's hot. I don't personally like the heat or the sun or the sand. I don't like anything fun, okay? But you're out there in the middle of the desert, and you're looking there, and you're seeing, you know, heat. You got your kids, you got your livestock, and no water. And they get to, finally, a little oasis of water, bitter. You can't even drink it. Yet, that's on the one side of the ledger. On the other side, they just saw the Red Sea part 3 days ago. Remember that? Remember the Red Sea? The Red Sea, at its lowest depth, is a football field deep. At its furthest depth, it's 2 miles deep, about 9,000 feet. We're talking about a huge, imagine looking up and seeing walls of water. So they just saw God rip apart this sea of, is there irony here? Water. And now they're saying, where's the water? Where's the water to drink? We don't have any water. So Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water at Marah, and the water became fit to drink. There the Lord issued a ruling and an instruction for them, and put them to the test. It isn't in the sense of Arab practice today where they have thorn bushes that they can mix in with water and it turns it from bitter into sweet tasting. This is a little piece of wood for an entire sea, a little pond of water for these people to drink, an innumerable, countless number of people. And so this is some kind of a miracle in the sense that Moses, too, used his staff, a piece of wood, to do miracles. So he throws the piece of wood in, and God does a miracle to bring this water to make it drinkable. Test number one. They didn't do that well, in case you weren't following along. Not that well. I'd give him a D- on that. Not good. Test number two. Prolonged hunger. We pick up in chapter 16, the whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. Again, I want to labor this point. This is a month after the Red Sea. To put that in perspective, January. January, you just saw walls of water and you escaped and you got out of this terrible empire of Egypt. It's only been a month. That's all it's been, according to Exodus 12. They're in the desert. The whole community's there, and they began to grumble against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around these pots of meat, man. We ate all the meat we wanted, but you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Okay, so we sat around the pots of meat. We ate all the meat you could eat, all you could eat meat. This is what we call revisionist history. When you see people having disappointment with God, this has a poisonous effect on your mind. And all of a sudden, your behavior, your thoughts, your beliefs begin to affect the way you think and even remember events. Case in point, they're not bringing up the infanticide, the homicide, the systemic racism and marginalization of the Israelites. They're not bringing up the slavery or the back-breaking labor. All they can say is, "Oh, that meat, man, remember that meat? It was so tasty. Oh, man, it was so great." That's like the one little thing in Egypt that was good, and everything else was a living hell. But now that they're disappointed with God, you know, what has God done for me this month? Not that much. All of a sudden, they start to have these daydreams about, oh, the longing to go back to Egypt. And so, too, they say, "We wish that we had died, that we had starved to death in Egypt as well." That's a little extreme, wouldn't you say? You would have rather starved to death in Egypt? See, this is also disappointment with God, polluting the mind, just warping it, the thinking, to the point where we're actually seeing wild accusations against God. That's what we're going to see throughout this entire passage. Is because they feel like God hasn't come through soon enough, whatever their arbitrary timetable was, we don't know what that was. If he had come through in 28 days, would they have not complained? Well, they came again 30 days, so now they're going to complain. All of a sudden, they're drawing a line in the sand, and they're saying, "We got some conditions here, and we would have wished that we would have died." How infantile, isn't it? It's like the little kid that can't get what he wants, and so he holds his breath, you know, trying to pass out in front of mom or dad. "I wish we would have died instead of being here with you, God." Ugh. The Lord said to Moses, "I will strike down upon you with great vengeance and furious anger, and you will know that I am the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon you." Which is not actually in the Bible. That's not what he said. That's actually Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction, which is not a verse in the Bible. Quentin Tarantino is asked about that. They're like, "What verse is that in Ezekiel?" He's like, "There's no verse like that in Ezekiel. I made it up." Anyways, isn't that what you would expect? Here we got these grumblers for the second time, and we wish we would have died already. And here we have God raining down what? Raining down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. What? "In this way, I will test them to see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day, they are to prepare what they are to bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gather on the other days." So Moses and Aaron said, "The Lord has heard your grumbling against him." Who are we that you should grumble against us? God has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we? You are not grumbling against, let's just make this clear. You're not grumbling against Aaron or Moses, but against the Lord. Full stop. You say, "Wait a minute, I just read that text for myself." In chapter 15, verse 24, and 16, verse 2, it says that they were grumbling against Moses. What are we seeing here? We're seeing an insight that Moses is going through the logic of what he's hearing, and he's realizing, if they're grumbling against me, who am I? I'm just somebody who's getting orders from God. And so really, they're grumbling against somebody way up the pay grade for me. Who am I? I didn't come up with this plan. This was not my idea. So they've actually gotten to the point where their conditions on God, their bitterness, their anger, putting God on trial, has raised it to the point where Moses has discerned they're actually angry with God himself. Grumbling. How many times does he say it? 1, 2, 3. Grumbling against God. Moses told Aaron, "Say to the entire Israelite community, 'Come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling.'" While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked toward the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. The Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. This is what I want you to tell them. At twilight, you will eat meat, and in the morning, you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord." That evening, quail came and covered the whole camp. And in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. That is a statement. That's what we call that, a statement. Oh, you thought they had good pots of meat back in Egypt, huh? Yeah, the meat was pretty good, God. It was all you can eat. All right, quail. And there's just quail everywhere. Quail as far, you can't step somewhere without stepping on a quail. And they're just plucking these things or cooking them up and just maybe just eating them raw like Ozzy Osbourne. I don't know what they're doing, but there's just quail for days here. This is what we call overkill. I'm not trying to make a pun. I'm just trying to make a point. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost covered the ground and appears on the desert floor. What's this about? When the Israelites saw this frost over the desert, that doesn't make sense. They said to each other, the appropriate question, what is it? We're out in the desert. We've been here for a month, and now there's frost on the sand. That you don't see that all the time. What is it? The Hebrew manu. And they didn't know what it was. Well, later in chapter 16, verse 31, the people of Israel called the bread manna. And it was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. So this is the original who's on first joke, where the people are turning to Moses saying, what is it? And Moses says, what is it? And then they come back and say, exactly, what is it? And Moses is like, that's right. What is it? You got it. What is it? Now you're getting it. What is it? You know, so it's just, what is it? I don't know. I guess that's what we'll call it. Manu, manna. Manna means, what is it? What is it? It is delicious. That's what it is. Must have had protein in there. There's maggots when they screw up later. And we see here a coriander seed. I'm not really into that. However, wafers like honey. In the ancient world, before you had processed sugar, you know, really sweet stuff. You know, at Halloween, when kids come around and you get to steal some of their candy and you're just, you know, wolfing that down, you know what I mean? I'm the only one? Okay. Just going to keep going here. And eating that down, you know, that's like the tastiest stuff. In the ancient world, they didn't have Fun Dip, all right? They didn't have Snickers. They didn't have any of that stuff. What they had was honey. Honey, baby. That's what tasted the best. And God is just letting this rain down from heaven. He does it for 40 years. Every morning, 6 days out of seven, they come out and there's this delicious, substantive food that gave them sustenance. And it tastes good and it meets all of their needs. Moses said to them, "It is the bread of the Lord that he's given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Everyone is to gather as much as they need. Take an omer, that's 2 quarts, for each person to have in your tent." The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some gathered little. Everyone gathered just as much as they needed. So 2 quarts, that'd be a lot of harvesting, especially with the sand in there too. But I bet the little kids weren't that good at it. The elderly, maybe people that, you know, were disabled, some gathered little, but then the other people gathered much, but it all balanced out. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul appeals to this with regard to financial giving. He cites Exodus 16, verse 18, where he says that what we're aiming for here is some kind of equality, that I don't have an abundance while I'm looking across the desert and seeing other people are starving to death. So this was God's ideal, is that people would have just enough, exactly as much as they needed, as he says right there. Then Moses said to them, "No one is to keep any of it until morning." You don't keep it for the next day. You get it every day. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses, so they kept part of it until morning. That's not going to be good. Let's see what happens. So it was full of maggots and began to smell, and so Moses was angry with them. What happens if you keep the manna overnight? It rots. It goes away. You can't store up a warehouse of manna. There's, you know, no 403C full of manna you can invest into. There's nothing like that. You can't put it in a bank of manna. And in the New Testament, 2 Corinthians 8, we read that this is illustrative. It's a foreshadowing the Christian view of money. what happens to your money? Not the next day, I suppose. It's not that your money goes away, though for some people, that certainly has been the case. The stock completely drops overnight and it's gone forever. However, regardless, if it's today, tomorrow, 80 years, 100, all of our money is going away. And the idea is just have enough to live on. That's all you need. You don't need to have some kind of a fortress of security with money. God provides the money. He's going to take care of that. Don't worry about that. And if we collect all this extra, oh, we're going to feel so safe overnight until we wake up and it's just rotted. All these possessions, what are they? They're nothing. They're rotted, maggot-filled, smelly manna. Verse 21, each morning everyone gathered as much as they needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, that'd be Friday, because they saved it until morning, and it didn't stink or get maggots in it. Moses said, 6 days you're to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, that's Saturday, there will not be any. So there was no manna on the Sabbath. Why? This is the first mention of the Sabbath in the Bible. And this is there to mention that God is going to give them a day of rest. So you can gather an entire gallon, 4 quarts, on Friday. And you carry that over with your family. You're not even supposed to leave the tent. You just hang out with the family, this delicious food, and you rest. That's all it is. Nevertheless, people didn't like that idea either. Like, just rest. No work. Just rest. Spend time with your friends. Talk about God together. Have some fun. Relax. Nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day of the Sabbath to work, but they found none of that manna was out there that day. It must have been a coincidence, huh? The Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? So the people learned to rest on the Sabbath day. Now, we're in a new covenant here today as Christians, so we're not obligated to rest on Saturday or Sunday, whatever day you want to pick. Indeed, this is what Paul tells us in Colossians chapter 2, verse 16, let no one be your judge as to festivals or new moons or Sabbath days. So you can choose whenever you want to take a break. That's Monday morning, Thursday night, whatever. It doesn't matter. You choose that. It's up to you. Still, a pretty good principle. God is giving the people a gift. Rest. Instead, the people want to work. And this is really what we see with us in God. It's what we see with religion in God. Is religion says, you got to do. God says, actually, it's done. Religion says you got to do a lot of works. You got to become a better person. You got to become more righteous. God says, actually, that's self-righteous. It's righteousness from yourself. Instead, what I want to do is give you my righteousness and forgive anything that you've done wrong. We have a real hard time sitting still and getting a gift of rest from God, just sitting there and enjoying that. We'd prefer works. Test number 3. How are they doing so far? I give them a failing grade. This is not going well. Every single point along the way, they're disobeying, they're grumbling, they're trying to grab more for themselves. And it's just a wreck. It's a complete freaking wreck here. And then now we're circling back again for round 2 of no water. This is the second time. We pick up in verse 1 of chapter 17. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim. This is the last stop, if you remember that map, on the way to Sinai, to Horeb. And this is where Mount Sinai is, where eventually they're going to get the Ten Commandments. So you're on a road trip. You're going all the way down to Florida, or wherever you go for fun. And you're like, there's that last stop, and then we make the last long haul, and we push, and we're going to make it, and there's no bathroom breaks, and nobody stops for Arizona iced tea, and we're going to make it to Florida on time. That's what they're expecting. We're going to hit the last final stop, Rephidim, and then we're going to make it to Sinai. Except, there's no water there. Oh, my God. We thought we were going to make it. The expectations have completely collapsed at this point. So they quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. We're sick of this. We're done with this. Give us the water. Moses replied, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test? Quarreled, that term is a very technical term in the Hebrew. It's the Hebrew word riv. It's spelled rib, but pronounced riv. This is a very litigious term in the Hebrew language and culture. It was used to take somebody to court. I'm going to sue you? No, that's not what they would say. That's what we say today. I'm going to bring a riv against you. I'm putting you on trial. I'm going to take you and put you on trial. I have a riv against you. You read about this in the prophets, the Hebrew prophets in the Old Testament. Repeatedly, we see that this word is used to, quote, describe God's litigation and case against his people. You think, for example, of, you know, Micah 6, where God says, I own the land, and you're not supposed to be in that land. I'm the landowner, and I'm bringing a riv against you. Ooh, that's not what you want to hear from God if he's your landlord. And yet, what we're seeing here is not that at all. It's not God bringing a riv against the people. It's the people are bringing a riv against God. What are we seeing? Why do you put the Lord to the test? Do you see the switch? Huge reversal. I hope you caught that. Earlier, it was God testing the people. Remember? God put them to the test. So God put, now it's the people are testing God. Now God is in the dock. Now God's on trial. We got some things to talk about. We're going to put you on trial and we're going to have you up there. And we've got some things we're going to convict you of. God, putting God to the test, having a quarrel there. The people were thirsty for water there and they grumbled against Moses. They said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and our livestock die of thirst? Here is the plaintiff taking the stand and saying, why would you do this? And it's the second time. Okay, and now they're bringing in the livestock and the kids. And here, Moses cries to the Lord. He says, what am I to do with these people? They're already ready to stone me. Whoa, that escalated quickly. First, it was just a little bit of grumbling. Right? What's the vernacular of our day? I'm just venting. Here, just doing a little bit of venting. Just need to blow off a little bit of steam. Just grumbling a little bit, just a little bit. And then the grumbling all of a sudden turns into accusation against God. And then it turns into these weird conspiracy theories, things that you're like, what? You think God would move heaven and earth to take you out of Egypt and part the sea just to let you die out there in the desert? What kind of a theory is this? And then it moves from there into what? Murder. Now, by this, I don't mean to imply that your bitterness in your heart or mine is going to lead you to murder someday, okay? What I'm saying is, logically speaking, there is a domino effect that if I give in to bitterness toward God at the beginning, if nothing halts or moves or diverts that process, it's going to keep right on going to places that we never even imagined. How did I ever get? Nobody wakes up one day and says, I'm going to deny God and hate his people. You don't do that. What happens is a slow slip in the heart. Let's analyze this for a moment. They're grumbling. Was I overdoing it there? I mean, was it really that bad that they're grumbling against God? I mean, it's not like they're asking for luxuries. They're asking for necessities, right? Water. Food? There's nothing wrong with that, is there? So two, this must have been terrible conditions. To be in that condition, those circumstances, to be dealt that hand, to be out in the desert for a month or six at this point, that would be pretty rough treatment. Where is God? God could just snap his fingers and he could part the sea and he's not doing it. And you know, we're not asking for much, but could we have water, please? Could we have food, please? And we've got kids out here. All right, we got our livestock out here. What is it really that bad to grumble in a situation like this? Answer, yes, it is. Yes, it is that bad. This is a serious sin against God. To have experienced God in your life, come in and rescue you, and then to turn around and point the finger at him and say, I've got a problem with you. You're going on trial. Let me tell you something. You're the one who deserves to be on trial, not him. We're the guilty ones, and we have the audacity to call him guilty. He's the innocent one, and he has the audacity to call us innocent. And to sit there and wave our fist at God brazenly, angrily, and say, I've got a problem with you, and I'm going to convict you of it. That's wrong. I mean, for one, they didn't request anything. There's no prayer here. You think God would have responded if they're sitting there saying, hey, we're dying, we're thirsty. Nobody prayed. Nobody said, God, hey, we need some water. What'd they do? Three times. They grumbled, and they grumbled some more. Have you ever had this happen? God, I'm asking for something that I need here, and, you know, my mouth has been, you know, jawing and running, and my heart's racing, my mind, you know, I'm anxious as anything, but then I realize I haven't prayed about this at all. So they haven't requested anything. They refuse to recognize the past, haven't they? This has been 6 months since the Red Sea at this point. They've seen the 10 plagues. They've seen the pillar of fire. They've seen the Red Sea part. They've seen the water turn from bitter to sweet. They've seen the manna falling from heaven for the last 5 months. They've seen all that, and they've blocked it out of their memory. It's not that they have amnesia. You follow me? It's that they're refusing to see the graciousness of God in his provision in their lives. Not a single word is mentioned about this. Nothing like, yeah, we're upset about this, but yeah, we do remember how you came through miraculously for the past year. The only thing they can say is, what have you done lately? They refuse to reason in the present. You know, think about this rationally. Would God do all of this and bring them out of Egypt just to let them fall over dead in the desert? Guys, that would be like if Liam Neeson, you know, goes across Europe and breaks 50,000 necks and rescues his daughter from a sex ring and brings her back home, and he gets her to the airport and he says, all right, get your own ticket. It's on you to get home. It's what? You know, you have the money. Why would you go through heaven and earth to save me and rescue me and just leave me there? Okay, God wouldn't do that. And I think we should pause for a second too. Many of us are like, God, you've abandoned me. I don't know what's going on here. You know, the need level is rising. This is so bad, so awful. And we need to pause and ask ourselves the question. If God has brought me this far, why would he abandon me now? Do you ever talk to yourself? I talk to myself frequently. And one of the things I like to do is ask myself the question, laughing usually, particularly when I get up to teach a Bible study. And I laugh and I ask myself, why are they letting me get up and do this? Who is allowing this to happen? Somebody should say something. How did I get here? Why was I, at one point in my life, hating God? I wanted nothing to do with God. God or got a hold of me, turned me around to the point where I actually love him. I love his people. I love the Bible. I love his word. I love talking to him. I love spending time with him. I love serving him. How is that possible? And he's brought me this far, and now I think he's just going to just, that's it? You're done? 2023, it's over, James. Over for you. That's not reasonable. I hope you can see that. Well, they refused to remember the past. They wouldn't reason in the present. And they refused to rely on God for the future. If this is what's already happened and this is what is happening, I can trust what will happen. The Lord answered Moses, go out in front of the people, take with you some of the elders, and take in your hand the staff which you struck the Nile with, and go. Let me explain this differently. Go out in front of the people. God is saying, I want this to be public. Okay? And take some of the elders. I want some witnesses. And, oh, what was that instrument of judgment that you used over Egypt? Remember that? What was that? Oh, the staff. Yeah. Someone's about to get it. Okay? And I want this to be all out in the open. And I want to have some people see this. And I want you to bring the staff of judgment that brought the 10 plagues and wrecked the sea and killed Egypt. And you ready? You're going to put me on trial? That's what this is? You're going to grumble against me? That's what this is? After all I've done for you, get the staff. We're going to meet out front in public. And here's where it gets real weird. Okay? This whole buildup. And then we read this. Moses, I'm going to stand before you by the rock at Horeb. And then I want you to strike that rock. Water will come out of it for the people to drink. So, Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. This huge windup for a big haymaker. And then he says, I want to stand before you. Did you know in the entire Old Testament, God never stands before humans? Humans stand before God. That's the way it works. It just doesn't work the other way, except here. This is a posture of humility. You stand before me. I don't stand before anybody. I'm God. Here we have God humbling himself before the people. Strike the rock. That's where God is standing. I will be on the rock, and I want you to take the staff, and I want you to strike the instrument of judgment and strike that rock. And from this act, it's going to quench the thirst of all my people, even though they're sinful and selfish and self-absorbed. This whole act is going to bring about the very thing that they need. Moses called the place Massah and Meribah. This was because the Israelites quarreled and tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Okay. The Israelites accused God of being cruel and unloving over and over and over and over. They were turning into enemies of God, haters of God. Yet, in an awesome act of humility, God stands before the people and allows himself to be struck by the staff of judgment to meet the needs of these people who hate him and have him on trial. Why would he go through this kind of abuse? Picture your God. Wouldn't you have a better case if you're on trial? If somebody brought a reeve against you, wouldn't you have a better thing to argue? Haven't you seen my great works? Haven't you seen the miracles? Instead, he just takes a very humble position and just says, strike the rock and I'll stand on the rock and I'll meet your needs. Why does he take the abuse? It's no wonder that the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 10 says this, I don't want you to forget about our ancestors in the wilderness long ago. All of them ate the same spiritual food. All of them drank the same spiritual water, for they drank from the spiritual rock. This is our story, right? And that rock was Christ. Paul's looking at this entire account in Exodus 17, and he's saying that foreshadowed Jesus Christ. The one who was innocent made the people innocent. The ones who were guilty accused God of being guilty. They put him on trial. And yet, in an incredible reversal, God met their needs instead of meeting his own. Let's bring this together just with two questions. I just want to close up. If there's anything you could take away here tonight. I know we went over a lot, but if we could distill this into two questions to consider. Have you placed God on trial in your heart? I don't know what kind of bitterness that you're holding on to, what kind of conditions that you've set with you and God where you feel like another question would be, do you have conditions on God as to how your life should have gone? I should be married by now. I should have a job by now. I don't know what it is, but I'll tell you who knows. You know. You know what kind of conditions that you've placed in your heart, and you're grumbling. You're saying to God, no further. This is a deeply inward issue. Many people around you can't see it. This is an inward issue of the heart where you have turned to God and said, you are on trial. I don't care what you've done in the past. I don't care about the things in the present. I am not going to take a step forward. I'll say to you, I speak with such passion about this passage because God confronted me with this passage. It was 3 years ago. I was going through all these tests and issues with my respiratory, throat, voice issues. Couldn't get solved. I didn't know what was going on with it. Finally, I got a diagnosis. It's incurable, and it's just going to be this persistent issue with my chest, throat. It's just nasty. I don't even want to get into it. And there was a certain level of sad irony where I felt like, God, you've called me to be a teacher of your word, and yet you've given me an issue with my voice and my throat that's going to be something that's going to be a thorn in my flesh for the rest of my life. So I tried to fix everything. I tried to go on a low acid diet. Yeah, the book I read was called Dropping Acid. Good title. And get rid of that, and that didn't work. And then I got off nicotine. I was hooked on nicotine, so I got off that. I thought that would fix it. That didn't help at all. It just made me irritable. And at one point, I quit, and then I started doing nicotine again, and I was back on it, and I was smoking. I hadn't smoked for a while. My body was like, dude, what are you smoking for? And I was like, I was kind of joking, but kind of serious, and I was like, because I'm bitter at God. And it was one of those moments where you say something, and then you realize that's actually true. I'm angry. I'm angry with God. That's why I've tried to do the right things. I went to the doctors, I went to the specialists and the neurologists and the thing, and nothing's working. And about a month later, I was sitting with the Lord in prayer. You ever sit with him in silent prayer? You just sit there, you don't say anything. And I felt God was speaking to me very clearly, not audibly, but clearly, saying, why are you angry with me? And at the time, man, I was so foggy. I remember feeling like angry. I'm not angry with you. I don't even know. I didn't know what that meant. It came totally out of left field. I'm serving you. You know, I'm still moving forward. I don't get what do you mean angry? And it bothered me. And I shared it with people. I don't know what this means. Month after that, I'm going through this passage, Exodus 17, listening to a Bible teaching. Teacher out of New York City was teaching through this, and he got to the end of this text and he said, you need to drop your conditions that you've placed on God. And I pulled over to the side of the road and just sat there in prayer. Nothing weepy, nothing emotional. It was just, it hit me like a knife in the heart. And I was like, God, I am dropping these foolish conditions that I've raised up against you. Okay? You are not on trial at all. You're so good. You've been so good to me. I love you, Lord. Love being with you. It felt so good to have that release of the heart, to be there with God and to feel that bitterness just release. And it's just no more conditions. It's just gone. Man, I want that for you. The only person this is hurting is you. The question is, are you going to drop this? Just say, I'm done accusing, putting you on trial. And I want to get back in with you in a living way. And I'll tell you what, you will feel the curtain lift and the excitement come back in your life like you wouldn't expect. Well, that's all we got for tonight. We laughed. We cried. We'll never be the same.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.